One family sees hope leave their home as death itself starts making its way inside. The family's matriarch does all she can to honor her late husband's memory, save her son from despair, and support the dreams of her daughter. But are dreams lies we tell ourselves? Is there hope for a family who the world is against? A family who already feels death inside the walls of their dwelling. The play, A Raisin in the Sun. The author, Lorraine Hansberry, and you're listening to Lit Society.
Let's get lit!
Hey, y'all. Hey, this is Kari.
And this is Alexis.
And you're listening to Lit Society, a show about books and drama. Alexis, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
Good, good. We're covering a play that you selected. And I really love this because we were in a play phase for a while last season. Yeah. I think that's when we did Fences. We did, what else? Not a Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. We still have to do that one. Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah. And then we did another one. We did The Importance of Earnest.
Thank you. Oscar Wilde. That was great fun. Well, today isn't necessarily fun, but it is some of the best writing. I'm sure, you know, a lot of our literati, including us, have ever read in life. This is just an iconic play, right?
It is.
In the lead character role, if you can say lead character, but in the main actor's role, I've seen, of course, Sidney Poitier in the in the film, which is very popular. I listened to one too with Ruby Dee husband. What's his name?
Otis
Redding. No.
Yeah,
Davis.
Ossie Davis.
And he was brilliant.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we dissect our
play. And don't forget Diddy.
I was going to. Glad on over that.
You can do that.
I heard he did great.
He did do great. I watched it. He did excellent. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We cannot discount that.
Right. Did you see him on Broadway? That's something you would do.
No. I watched the movie.
Oh, okay.
When it came out as a movie. Yeah. I didn't know he was on Broadway, though.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, you guys, before we dive into this week's play, let's discuss our theme of the week. The lasting effects of covenants and redlining. As you listeners know, usually we choose the theme to discuss inspired by the book or play we're reading. And this week is no different. This week's theme is about really the founding of modern America, but it's a history that a lot of people are ignorant of.
Me included.
Oh, okay. So Alexis, so I know that's not true. But I like how you're trying to not, I don't know, ostracize people who don't know. You don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, I know Alexis is not being 100% truthful because we've read, of course, Isabel Wilkerson's Cast and Warmth of Other Suns. I believe Stamp talked about this ritual. However, Alexis, could you please define covenants and how they led, maybe not how they led to redlining, but what does that mean? When we say covenants and redlining, what are we talking about?
I think that's a conversation about contracts made to prevent Blacks from living within a certain area.
Yeah, so. Bullseye. And these type of contracts, these gentlemen's agreements even, have long-reaching consequences into today, into our present life.
Unfortunately,
right? Well, I wanted to discuss the history, briefly, of covenants, of redlining, of state-sponsored segregation, where it's left us today and where it's going to, the future it's created for us. How about that? Mm-hmm. Okay. So getting into the history, I found this article on NPR from an author who wrote about the subject, and that author's name is Richard Rothstein. He says that the housing programs began under the New Deal and were tantamount to, of course, state-sponsored segregation, as we said. The government's efforts, now this is a quote from the author, Rothstein, the government's efforts were primarily designed to provide housing to white, middle class, lower middle class families. This is a practice, listeners, that affects, however, everyone that's listening that lives in America. And we'll tell you why. The author goes on to note that the Federal Housing Administration, which was established in 1934, and a side note, is also looked on as like progress, as a way to make homeowning and real estate an inclusive thing. But it's only inclusive for a certain section of the population. So that's not inclusive, right? Well,
right.
The FHA furthered the segregation efforts by refusing to insure mortgages in and near African-American neighborhoods. This policy was known as redlining. At the same time, they were subsidizing builders who were mass producing entire subdivisions for white people, with the requirement that none of these homes be sold to African-Americans. So what do you think was the goal of the FHA and its supporters at the time?
To keep segregation alive and well.
Yeah, but you could have segregation and just provide mortgages to Black families in specific neighborhoods. The FHA refused to insure mortgages in and near Black neighborhoods.
Insure mortgages. Keep them poor.
Keep them poor.
Keep them poor.
Mm-hmm. This is the goal. Yeah. It is a goal to, as Cast and Stamped touch on two books we read in the past, keep this hierarchy in America. It wasn't just to keep the races separate. It was to keep one set of the population economically deprived.
Yeah, because without insurance, when something bad happens, you have to scrape together. If you don't have a cushion in your bank account or a backup in the form of insurance, you have to put that together yourself. And if you can't afford to do that, then you're just down and your property goes down.
So your property and everyone that lives near you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great point. No doubt you're not a nuclear family where it's just two parents and a child. Right. You might have two or three generations under one home. Well, there was no basis for this claim. The NPR article goes on to state factually on the part of the FHA, because in fact, when Black Americans tried to buy homes in all white neighborhoods or in mostly white neighborhoods, they were forced to pay double, triple what white families would have to pay. And this is something that Mama touches on in the play that we're reading today. And this was because for Black Americans, their housing supply was so restricted and they had so few choices. So the rationale that the FHA used was never based on any kind of study. It was never based on reality. So
you can say that again.
However, there is a good point in that, yes, it had this side effect that was indeed intended of segregating African Americans. The term redlining comes from the development by the New Deal, by the federal government, of maps of every metropolitan area in the country, every city. And those maps were color coded by first the Homeowners Loan Corporation and then the FHA, and then adopted by Veterans Administration. And these color codes were designed to indicate where it was safe, quote unquote, to insure mortgages. And anywhere where Black Americans lived, anywhere where African Americans lived nearby, were colored red to indicate to appraisers that these neighborhoods were too risky to insure. So what are the facts? Well, when the Great Migration began in 1915, Black Southerners started moving in droves to the Northeast, Midwest, and West. And their hope was to what, Alexis?
Build, start new, build family, build, you know, care for their family in the way they didn't, couldn't ask, well, safely.
Yeah, sure. Of course. Yeah. And to flee from the racist depravity of Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Black people soon realized, though, that segregation and racism awaited them in places like Chicago, Washington, and L.A., particularly when it came to housing. Some people may visit Chicago or other big cities throughout the country. Some people have families that have lived in this country for centuries, and they just assume that Black people live in one part of the city and white people live in another for reasons perhaps that are more economical than they are nefarious. Well, right. In Corrigan versus Buckley, the high court ruled that a racially restrictive covenant in a specific Washington, D.C. neighborhood was a legally binding document between private parties, meaning that if someone sold a house to a Black family, it voided the contract. That ruling paved the way for racially restrictive covenants around the country. And in Chicago, for instance, the General Counsel of the National Association of Real Estate Boards created a covenant template with a message to real estate agents and developers from Philadelphia to Spokane, Washington, to use it in communities. So if you don't know exactly how to word this racially hateful document, we got a template for you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Chicago has a long history of racial segregation in housing.
It's considered one of the most segregated cities in the United States, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Chicago even served as the headquarters of the National Association of Real Estate Boards, which was a clearinghouse for ideas about real estate practices. Mm-hmm. So these discriminatory practices led to zoning and redlining, and they picked up where the covenants left off, creating something that was legally backed. Chicago was home of also, though, one of the earliest landmark restrictive covenant cases in the country, and that's Hanbury versus Lee. Carl Hansberry. Do you know who he was?
Yes, yes, yes. That is the father to Lorraine Hansberry.
That's right. He was a Black real estate broker and father of playwright Lorraine Hansberry. He bought a home in the all-white Woodlawn neighborhood on the city's south side. That's right. All-white Woodlawn. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was 1937. After a neighbor objected, the case went to court, ultimately ended up before the U.S. Supreme Court. In this case, Hansberry prevailed. But things didn't change overnight.
Right.
So in conclusion, what is this left us with? Well, there are lawyers, by the way, in the field of real estate who know nothing about how covenants are baked into the country. And I know that because in this specific NPR article, they interviewed one. And I'll also leave our sources in the notes. But racism is still very much alive. These covenants, this redlining has effects. Today, African-American incomes on average are about 60% of the average white incomes. But Black American wealth is about 5% of white wealth. That means most middle class families in this country gain their wealth from equity they have in their homes. So this enormous difference between a 60% income ratio and a 5% wealth ratio is ultimately attributable to federal housing policy implemented through the 20th century. Now in 1968, the country passed the Fair Housing Act that said, okay, Blacks, you can now buy homes. But it's an empty promise because those homes are no longer affordable to the families that could have afforded them when white people were buying those homes. So the white families sent their children to college with the home equities. They were able to take care of their parents in old age and not depend on their children. They were able to bequeath wealth to their children. None of those advantages were accrued to Black American families who, for the most part, were prohibited from buying homes in those suburbs. And that is a brief history on covenants and redlining and, of course, a look into their lasting effects. Alexis, should we take a break before we get into the play?
Yes, let's definitely. Let's do it.
Okay. What can you tell us about Lorraine Hansberry and perhaps her inspiration for writing A Raisin in the Sun?
Well, Lorraine Hansberry was born to a middle class family on the south side of Chicago, as you mentioned, in May of 1930. She's the youngest of four. Her father founded one of the first banks for Blacks in Chicago, and he ran a successful real estate business, as you mentioned. Her mother was a school teacher. Her uncle was a scholar of African studies at Howard University, and her cousin was one of the first Black Americans to direct off-Broadway. Mm. Her parents were prominent members of the Black community, and her father worked for the NAACP. They were so prominent when prominent members of the Black community came into Chicago. Chicago. They showed up at their home, W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, Langston Hughes, Duke Ellington, and Jesse Owens. Her parents, as Kari mentioned, are responsible for helping outlaw housing discrimination across the U.S. When they sued about Chicago's restrictive housing. Lorraine met her husband, Robert Nimroff, a Jewish writer at New York University. Her husband wrote a hit song about that allowed Lorraine to quit working and devote herself to writing. They actually divorced in 1962, but the couple remained friends until her death. She started working on a play called The Crystal Stair, and that's from Langston Hughes.
She was just a big fan of Langston Hughes then, because The Raisin in the Sun is also from his Harlem poem, right?
Yeah, Langston's poem, Mother to Son. She would later retitle it Raisin in the Sun, from Langston Hughes' poem, Harlem, A Dream Deferred. A Raisin was the first play written by a Black American woman to be produced on Broadway and the first with a Black director. It first hit the stage in 1959 and closed in 1960 after 530 performances. In 1960, it was nominated for four Tony Awards, Best Play, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Director. Her inspiration for the play came from the lives of the working class Black people who rented from her father and who went to school with her on the South Side. She also used members of her family as inspiration for her characters. In an interview, she said Benny, the daughter, was her when about 8 years ago at the time of this interview. So that's all I'll share about our writer. Let me just say this. The play was adapted for screen in 1961 and again in 2008. And it was adapted for TV in 1989. And Lorraine died of cancer at the age of 34 in 1965.
Yeah, that's really tragic. I know that.
So, Kari, who do you think would enjoy reading this book?
Well,
or this play?
Yeah, a few plays about Black American living come to mind, but this play rings true in a way that reminds me of August Wilson's series. And so I will say, if you are a fan of, what is the name of that series again? Sorry to push you on the spot.
I don't remember. Sorry.
Okay. Well, it'll come to us. But if you like Fences and whatnot, then I think you will also enjoy this. It's not so much getting enjoyment or languishing in the suffering of Black Americans, but it's skillfully and artfully telling about a period of time that this population lived through. So yeah, if that interests you, and why shouldn't it? Then I think you will love this play, which is it's like an iconic play. Like, you should, I don't 100%. Care what you like, you should definitely read this.
100%.
And Alexis, what made you choose A Raisin in the Sun for our pick this week?
Now, I can't say the first time I watched this play, but I have watched it on more than five occasions.
It's easy to get through. As soon as it starts, you like, I'm gonna just watch a little bit, and then it's over.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I watched it again.
Yeah. Sidney Poitier is the first person I watched perform it. I think I started watching the one where, what's his name? Oh, I can't think of his name right now. Anyway, I can't think of his name, but I've watched several adaptations of it, and I really love it. So I'm like, why not read it as one of my plays?
I feel like Denzel was in
Really?
Iteration too.
Oh, I guess I missed that one.
Yeah, I love Sydney's accent in this movie because it goes in and out. He's younger, you know?
Yeah, for sure, younger.
So sometimes you're like, where are you from? Because that's not Chicago. But anyway, the acting is brilliant, of course. Mm-hmm. Did you cry when you first saw this? Do you remember?
You know, I can't say that I've ever teared up watching it.
Oh, okay. You know, the acting is so heartfelt sometimes with Mama's lines when she's talking about her husband. Mm-hmm. I cry a bit. But anyway, August Wilson's series is The Century Cycle. And Alexis, without further ado, let's hop into Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun. Please, the floor is yours. Spoilers ahead.
Of course. Let's do it. Okay. So the play takes place sometime between World war.
Why do you do this to yourself? Like, if you have a problem with W words, why would you put two of them in the beginning of your deep dive? That's you.
Well, I have to practice at some point and get it together at some point in my big age.
You're doing great, sweetie.
Anyway, between then and 1959 on Chicago's South Side, it takes place mostly in a two-bedroom apartment. Residing in the apartment are the Younger family, the family matriarch, who is Lena Younger. She's in her 60s. Her son, Walter Lee, who's 35. His wife, Ruth, who is 30, and the son, Travis, who I think is about 10. I don't remember hearing the age. And Benethia Younger, which is Walter's younger sister, Benny, 20 years old, and she is a student. The apartment building they live in has a shared bathroom on their floor. The son, Travis, sleeps on the sofa. But Benethia, or I'll call her Benny. Benny shares a room with her mom.
Yeah, and they share that bathroom. It's like a tenement building with like two or three other families.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they all working. So, you know, the mornings are tough.
Mornings are tough. So the whole initial beginning of the play is people trying to get to the bathroom before everybody else. And so that's a constant conversation in the initial act of the play, initial act and scene of the play. Mm-hmm. So the play begins with Ruth Younger, the Walter's wife, waking up the son to get ready for school, get in the bathroom before the neighbor gets in. And she wakes up her husband and tells him to get moving before he starts complaining about Mr. Johnson. And he, of course, he slowly rises. When Walter wakes up, he's immediately asked if the check is coming today. And Ruth reminds him they said Saturday and today is Friday. From her response, Walter senses his wife is in a mood. She doesn't really reveal. She just says, yeah, nothing's wrong with me. Travis returns from the bathroom, tells his father to hurry before Mr. Johnson gets in the bathroom. And while his father is in the bathroom, Travis asks his mom if the check is coming tomorrow. Again, another question about this darn check. Mm-hmm. Ruth tells him to get his mind off the money and eat his breakfast. He tells his mom he needs to bring 50 cents to school this morning. And mom tells him they just don't have it. Travis is upset because he even offers options like carrying groceries. But she tells him he can't even do that. And so he doesn't eat his breakfast and there's a little fuss in the morning.
And you forgot to mention before Travis even comes out of the bathroom, one thing his dad says is first thing a man ought to learn in life is not to make love to no color woman first thing in the morning. You all some evil people at 8 o'clock in the morning. And any other day, maybe this would be playful banter, but Walter is like being really mean to Ruth. Unjustifiably so.
Yeah, I guess I can agree with
that. I never liked Walter. But I will try to keep it together. He act like he carrying so many loads. And everybody don't have dreams. Everybody got dreams. Okay? It ain't just you.
He really does.
But I digress. Please, Alexis, you were doing great. The baby didn't eat the breakfast.
He didn't eat the breakfast. He can't get the 50 cents from mom. He asked if he can get it from grandma. Like I said, he asked if he can carry groceries. Maybe daddy will give it. Mom's like, shut up about that already. Ruth also tells Travis not to ask his grandma for money. And he's like, well, grandma just give it to me. So she liked me. That's how that works. So he's soaking.
Relatable.
and he gets a mild scolding from his mom. And then they have this little cute moment where she tries to restore him to showing love before he leaves for school. His father returns from the bathroom and kind of overhears the discussion about Travis carrying groceries after school. And Walter tells her, don't tell that boy we ain't got no money. Don't do that. And he gives Travis 50 cents and tells his boy to go buy some fruit and maybe even take a taxi to school.
What's the harm in the boy earning his own 50 cents?
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't understand why she said, no, you can't even earn it yourself. I don't know.
And she is very dismissive of her child. She's a very children are to be seen and not heard kind of mama.
Yeah.
And grandma don't like that either.
Speaking of which, so Walter asked Ruth if she wants to know what he was thinking about in the shower about Willie Harrison. He was talking about him and Willie Harris was talking about last night. She's like, listen, I know what y'all was talking about. And Willie Harris is good for nothing loudmouth, okay, while you're at it. And Walter complains, now, why is my friend a good for nothing? And
yeah, if he my friend, he must be a good for nothing, huh? And I'm like, right. Walter. Ooh.
Walter is going through it, okay? And so Ruth said, he tells Ruth, Charlie Atkins was a good for nothing too, right? And there he is in his dry cleaning business, making $100,000 a year.
Oh, is it $100,000?
$100,000
a year.
And you still call him a loudmouth. He tells her that you just tired of everything, but won't do nothing to help. And mind you, it's early in the morning. So they got to start the day early just to get in the bathroom. And he talking about you. What you look, tired of? What?
I already see where this episode going. Literati, if y'all ain't read the play, we got to talk. What is Walter's problem? Look. Because I understand you have the weight of the world on your shoulder, but you ain't carrying it alone.
Mm-mm. He ignores the value that his wife contributes.
Yes, he is at a point in his life where he is having existential questions bombarded in his mind. And it's like the worry is creating more problems that aren't even there, to the point where he is like, he feels his existence is for naught. And that's mm-hmm. real. Yeah. Like questioning your purpose in life. Anyway, I get it. I get that he's having this existential crisis, but it is no excuse to dismiss the women in his family specifically.
Yeah. Like I said, he tells his wife that a man needs a woman to back him, as if she hasn't been backing him the years they've been married. He tells her, mama would listen to you more than she does me and Benny. All you got to do is sit down with a cup of coffee and tell her about the deal, about the liquor store that Walter Lee is interested in. And he tells her this is not a fly-by-night proposition. Me, Willie, and Bobo, we gonna do this.
He is asking his wife to talk his mama out of her money.
Yeah. The liquor store is gonna cost $75,000. And all we got to do is put in $10,000 each one of us, and I could get it from that check. Listen, Ruth doesn't want to talk about it, and she reminds Walter that the money is not his. Ruth tells Walter, he talks about the same thing every night, every day. Nothing is new. And he says, it's no thanks to the colored woman. They ain't helping him get nowhere.
All women. I know I ain't helping them. You right.
So then Benny comes in, the sister. She's fussing about Mr. Johnson in the bathroom. Again, that's a conversation all the morning. And Walter tells her that she needs to get up earlier. So that's a little conversation. Mm-hmm. The brother and sister kind of get into an argument about Benny going to school, wanting to be a doctor, and using mama's money to further her education. Now, why would she do that? And Benny tells Walter, the money belongs to mama. She can use it how she wants.
It's interesting because I don't feel like Walter, right?
Yep, I'm saying Walter.
I don't believe Walter is jealous of his sister and that he too wants to go to school.
No,
that's not what it's about at all. He just doesn't see the value in educating her as a woman. And that money would be put to better use to fund his dreams.
And how does that come out exactly, Kari, when he shows that he don't think her going to school to be a doctor is it?
Well, they have this back and forth, and he ends it with, why don't you marry somebody so you can finally be quiet?
Absolutely. He says that. And he says that, why don't you just be a nurse like all the rest of the women if you want to help people?
She wants to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. By the way, like, is the nurse, is that an insult? Like, I don't know. I didn't know what he was talking about. I don't care for him.
He's
as a person.
Diminishing. Just, you know, the idea that she wants to be a doctor. Who are you to aspire to that? Just be a nurse like the rest of the black women.
Yeah.
Or women, period.
Yeah.
Walter tells her she's unappreciative. Everybody is working but her while she goes off to school. So he's just over it. Ruth tells him to stop before mom, they wake up or bother mom. And Benny again reminds him it's mama's money. And Walter tells him it was his father too. Benny says the insurance money is for mama.
Yeah, it was his father, but not his wife. I'm sorry. I'm going to stop interrupting you. That's rude. I'm going to mute my mic every time you mention Walter.
She obviously has problems with Walter. Okay. Anyway. The money is not for Walter to invest in some liquor stores. Walter just says people don't understand him and don't want nothing. And he storms out. Before he does, he asks Ruth for car fare because he done gave the change. Gave the change to the boy. Yeah.
And so I don't know why. I don't know why. All that money's coming from the same pot. He just wants to look, be in a certain light to his child.
Yes.
But that very child obviously would value more if you treated your wife, his mother, with respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially as she's working the skin off of her fingers for you and the family.
So mom wakes up. Mama wakes up and
thank goodness, because she the only one with some sense.
She's like, who's slamming this door in my house at this hour in the morning? Again, it's early in the morning. Everybody getting ready to go out. Benny runs to the bathroom, tells mama not to worry about it. Mama tells Ruth she got to take better care of herself because she noticed something about Ruth. She's just not looking well this morning. And mom comments how thin she looks. She even then comments on how she's caring for Travis. Like, you need to take better care of my boy. You worrying about things he don't need to be worried about. Give him some money when he want it. Ruth complains that mama is spoiling him. And when Benny leaves, mom asks Ruth what her children were fighting about. Ruth tells her that she knows. And mama says, brother, she calls Walter brother, is going to worry himself sick about that money. It's too early to talk about money. Ruth then asks what she's going to do with the money, and mama says she hasn't decided. She tells mama Walter Lee got his heart set on that store. And mama tells her she ain't that we're not business people. We just working folk. We ain't about investing.
Mama, I was believing in you, but I get it. Because mama is of a generation where you don't dream past your role in society. Mm. And so they are a working family. They need to be focused on working, not investing. Not building money for future wealth.
Yeah. And then the idea of investing in a liquor store is against her moral principle as well.
Now that I understand completely. She like, maybe if you think of some other way to invest our money, but why in the world this close to my death would I be invested in liquor stores?
In a liquor store, yeah. She said, I am, however, thinking about putting the money aside for Benny and buying a 2-story house. So that's what I'm thinking. She said, Ruth actually suggests that she take a trip around the world like the white women do. She said, I ain't never look like no white woman. What I look like taking a trip around the world? She couldn't see past it.
Yeah.
Benny, a little bit about Benny. Benny is the daughter, again, the sister of Walter Lee. She's kind of a modern woman who says things like, if I get married, and she won't marry no rich suitor just because he has money. And she says things like, I'm sick of hearing about God. And when she said that, she said it. One thing wrong, you know, one more wrong thing, and she got slapped by her mama.
So I thought this scene is very pivotal to the play because Benny feels like her mother and no one in her family supports her. Meanwhile, in all of her plans, mama is thinking about Benny. How can I support Benny? How can I support her dreams? However, Benny is very headstrong and at this point in her life, atheistic, or she's an atheist. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't respect other people's ideas or faith. Mama lets it go one time. 2 times. Benny continues. And Benny said, I'm sick of God getting all the credit for things man does himself. And that's when mama has to slap her.
Insert slap here, because it was hard.
Yes, has to. And mama said, in this house, you repeat after me, you say in this house, in my mama's house, there is still a God. Because you are in your mother's house.
You're still in your mother's house.
This is just basic respect.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you going to talk about her suitor from Nigeria?
No, I'm going to skip the suitors.
Well, real quick, can I just...
Absolutely. Insert.
So Benny is wasting the time of this man in Nigeria.
She's wasting the other man's time.
Yeah, so she's not really wasting his time.
Nigerian.
His
fa-
So the Black American is wealthy, comes from a wealthy uppity family, and her mom and family want her to just go ahead and marry him already. Like, that's inevitable. And she is wasting his time. But the Nigerian, they wasting each other's time. Now, he comes by the house, and she tells mama, don't be asking him if they wear clothes in Africa and all that other stupid stuff people ask Africans. And mama is like, well, I guess I won't be saying nothing stupid and embarrassing you in my own house. Don't have him come over then if you don't want to be embarrassed. And she like, I'm just saying, you keep donating to them. You know, why do you donate? She said, because everybody needs to, you need not suffer or something like that. And her daughter, Benny's like, well, they need to worry about not suffering at the hands of the French and the English.
Yeah.
And so when he comes in the house, mama's like, oh, hello and welcome to our home. You know, it's so good to meet you. People just always donating for this and that when really they need to be worried about worry about the suffering at the hands of the French and the English. And the Nigerian man is kind of like, yeah, thank you. Thanks, mama. But it's cute because once the door closed, he obviously fine. Because when the door closed, mama's like, oh, I see why we care so much about Africa these days. It's cute.
Yeah, it is. It's
and it shows
cute.
That she listens to her daughter.
Yeah.
And but later on, when that uppity Black American comes around and he's aggressive in his touchy-feeliness and also dismissive of her ideas, she tells mama like he's a fool. And mama says, are you sure? And she says, yes. And she said, don't waste your time with no fool then. And then Benny goes, thank you, mama. Mama says, for what? For supporting me this time. Which I'm like, Benny, all these kids.
Yeah. Her children are really something else. They're a piece of work, to say the least. So after she gets slapped, Ruth tells mama that Benny apologized, but she actually didn't. She was a little bit more disrespectful as she walked out of the, I will say more disrespectful as she walked out of the house. And mama asked Ruth to sing a song that she likes because they've just had this emotional, contentious conversation. And she's like, well, just sing this song. I like, you know, I really like to hear that. Meanwhile, Ruth passes out. The next day is Saturday. We know we're expecting that check. Benny answers the phone and it's Willie Harris. Remember, Willie Harris is the one that's talking about this. I won't call it a scheme. I'll call it a plan and this investment plan. Walter asks Willie if he got the papers from the lawyer. Walter tells him the mailman doesn't get there until 10:30. But they're excited about this check. Ruth comes home looking dejected and Benny asks right out, is you pregnant?
And Benny goes, where that baby supposed to live? On the roof? That's I didn't mean that, Ruth. I didn't mean that.
She meant every little bit of it. Meanwhile, mama is excited because she's hoping it's a girl. Come on, baby girl. So Ruth is about 2 months pregnant and Benny asks if it's planned. And Ruth, again, is like, that's my business. It's like, so what?
No, it's not planned. We all live in one room. Benny, to go to school, you ain't too bright.
No.
My goodness.
Anyway, the check arrives and Ruth and Travis kind of watch mama open up the check with excitement. And mama asks Ruth where she was this morning. And mama seems to know where she went. And she asked her, did she go and see about that woman? And the woman that she's talking about is a woman that does abortions. She's not happy. And just as the conversation is about to get going, Walter enters in with great excitement because he's asking about the check. And he has these papers in his hand and he's like, mama, look at the papers, though, because, oh, Willie, he put everything down and right and he made it ready for you. Mama's right here. And mama is like really blowing off Walter. And mama tells Walter to talk to his wife. And Walter says, I can talk to her later. And he's insisting that mama look at the papers. And he yells, somebody please listen to me. Mama tells him she ain't investing in no liquor store and we ain't talking about it again. Frustrated, Walter crumples the papers and tells mama to tell it to his son when he has to sleep on the living room couch. When his wife and his mama got to look after somebody else's children and work in somebody else's kitchen. And then he storms out and Ruth is like, I'm going to come with you, Walter. And Walter said, don't come with me. I don't want you. Mama sits, insists that he come and sit down. He like, Mama, I'm grown. I remember this scene so well with Sydney Poitier. He's like, Mama, I'm grown. She's like, I ain't say you not grown, but come on and sit down here, boy. He sits down and Ruth says, let him go. He makes me sick. Walter says she was his biggest mistake. Mama tells Walter that she has watched him change over the past 2 years. And when people ask him a question, he yells. He leaves the house to go drink. And she warned him not to drive his wife away. She tells him it's dangerous when a man leaves his house to look for peace. Walter tells his mom there ain't no other woman. I know that's what y'all go to, but there ain't no other woman. He just wants so many things that it's driving him crazy. And he wants more than the job that he has. He says he can see the future plain as day just waiting for him. And it's a big looming blank space. Mama tells him that Ruth is expecting and planning to get rid of the baby. And Walter's like,
you don't know Ruth. She wouldn't do that.
She would not do that.
And then she came out the closet that they call a bedroom. And she's like, yes, I would too.
She said, and that leaves Walter pretty much speechless. And he leaves. He leaves.
No, this is a great scene. Is he speechless?
He just said, yeah. And she keeps telling him to say something.
You're right.
And he said he has nothing to say. He has nothing to say. And he storms out.
Mama has some impressive lines here where she's like, you know, be your father's son.
Yep.
Tell your wife that in this family, we don't get rid of babies. We raise babies.
Yep.
Tell her now. Tell her now. If you ever were my son, you tell her now.
And he walks out. Nothing.
Oh, this is when I'm crying.
Yeah.
And Alexis just cold blooded. She got an ice box where her heart used to be. Shout out to Mario.
I'm a sensitive person. I could watch it now. Maybe I will shed a tear. Mm-hmm. It hits different at different ages in your life.
Ain't that the truth? Mm-hmm.
Walter returns after having been drinking and everybody knows it. And this is when I think one of the boyfriends is there and he cut up.
Yeah, the African, the Nigerian man.
Yeah. And when Walter and Ruth are alone, she tries to talk to him about the baby. But Walter doesn't want to. He says he doesn't even care about her. And they try to talk again. And then Walter kind of breaks his mood and expresses honestly that he's having a hard time a little bit. Mom walks in and Walter's like, where you been? And she ignores him. He says, you didn't do nothing crazy with that insurance money, didn't you?
Oh, did you?
And she tells him, actually, she brings in her grandbaby and tells him. She tells him that she bought a house in a neighborhood that doesn't necessarily accept color folks. She don't say it like that, but that's what she did.
No, she talk about how nice the house is. Everybody excited. And they like, where is it? And she's like, Woodlawn.
And everybody is happy but Walter.
Mm-hmm.
He tells his mama she butchered a dream of his. And he leaves again. He just doing the same thing she say. He just leave every time nobody agree with him.
So this is a crucial character flaw in my eyes to the man of Walter, because Mama has taken her money that she received because of her husband and done something for everyone. And he's mad.
Everyone.
That it wasn't something for him personally.
He said, you butchered my dream, a dream of mine that I had.
He did not earn this money. It was not his wife that caused the receiving of this money. It was his father, his mother's husband. Mm-hmm. And I understand Walter, though, is having a early life crisis, truly, and is not able to go to a therapist.
For real, he's not.
Yeah.
No, this is different times.
But I don't like him.
Okay. I think we get that.
Okay.
A few weeks later, Walter hasn't been to work in like 3 days, and the employer calls and says if he don't come in tomorrow, they'll replace him. Walter seems unconcerned. Mama asks him about what he's been doing, and he's like, he's been driving around.
Walter is so stupid. Oh, it's so stupid. Walter went to the South Side to look at black people and to see them looking at him. Oh, Walter. I get it. He's looking at the way the world's run. He's looking at, what is it, like the industrial part of town? Mm-hmm. And then he's looking at the black people who aren't benefiting from it, and himself included.
Yeah.
I think in the movie he lost his job and didn't tell anyone, which no, I think is a little better.
Oh, is okay. All right.
Yeah, I haven't watched it all the time. It's a few changes in the movie. Like they even be looking around the house that mama buy.
Yeah, at the end of the movie, right? Okay. So Mama enters the scene and she tells Walter she's been wrong. She tells him it ain't worth holding on to money if it means it's going to destroy her son. So she takes out an envelope and gives her son $6,500 and tells him she paid $3,500 for the house and the rest she wants to go. He can have it, and $3,000 she wants to go to Benny's schooling. And then he can put the rest of the money in the account with his name on it. And from now on, any penny that come out of that account that's got his name on it, he can decide where it go. And she can tell him, and she tells him that he's the head of the family. You can be the head and make all the decisions. Walter's like, you trust me like that, Mama? You do? She tells him, I ain't never stopped trusting you. And Walter is just so happy, right? Like, Mom has now entrusted him with this $6,500. And he can now...
I don't think... So, in our eyes, he's happy because his mother trusts him. Mm-hmm. Walter is just happy to receive the money.
He's happy to receive... No, yes, I wasn't trying to imply he was happy because his mom trusts him. He was happy because he got the check. Point, period. So this, but he has this joy now because he then goes and he sits and he talks to his son and almost like putting him to bed. And he's like, I'm going to make a business transaction for you, son, that's going to change our lives. A week later, it's moving day and everybody is in a pleasant mood. Mama's not home. And what happens, Kari? We get a visitor from the Housing Association. And what does the Housing Association man say?
He said, look, he's white and he's from the Housing Association of the white neighborhood that the mama bought a house in. And he's like, hey, y'all, how you doing? I love that people can come together and fellowship.
I love it.
And talk. Like humans.
Mm-hmm. Human. Now,
first of all, congratulations on everything you got going on here. As in the white delegation, we understand how hardworking people need to be communicated with. And so we are communicating with y'all that we don't want black people in our neighborhood. It's not funny. And the whole family is like, you came over here to say
this. Yeah, that's what happened.
And then mama come home. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
It's funny because mama come home and they all sitting around depressed and she like, y'all need to be packing. And they like, oh, mama, you had a visitor today. And she said, who was it? And they like, oh, it was the man that represent that neighborhood you bought a house in. He just want us to all fellowship and hate. You know, sit down and talk to each other like decent people that hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He left his car and mama's like, oh, what has the world come to?
Mm-hmm.
So she understands.
Who's the next visitor, Kari?
Who's the next visitor?
Bobo.
Oh no. I don't want to talk about this.
We're gonna have to talk about it because this is how we're gonna conclude it. Okay. Bobo shows up. Remember him? He's the one that went in.
Bobo the fool. That's where the name came from.
Willie Harris and Walter to start the business. Mm-hmm. Walter is so excited that Bobo is here. He like, where Willie? Where? Bubba said, let me get a drink before we talk about Willie, okay? Just let me get a drink. And then he kind of fumbles over the words, and then I would like to read for you.
Oh, yay.
Ooh. He says, this deal that me and Walter went into with Willie, me and Willie was going to go down to Springfield and spread some money around so we wouldn't have to wait so long for the liquor license. That's what we were going to do. Everybody said that was the way you had to do it. You understand, Miss Ruth? Man, what happened down there? I'm trying to tell you, Walter. Tell me, what's the matter with you? Man, I didn't go to no Springfield yesterday. Why not? Because I didn't have no reasons to. Man, what are you talking about? I'm talking about the fact that when I got to the train station yesterday morning, 8 o'clock, like we planned, man, Willie didn't never show up. Why? Where was he? Where is he? That's what I'm trying to tell you. I don't know. I waited 6 hours. I called his house and I waited 6 hours. I waited in that train station 6 hours. That was all the extra money I had in the world. Man, Willie is gone. Gone? What do you mean Willie is gone? Gone where? You mean he went by himself? You mean he went off to Springfield by himself to take care of getting the license? You mean maybe he didn't want too many people in on the business down there? You know, Willie got his own ways. Maybe you was late yesterday and he just went on down there without you. Maybe he's been calling you at home trying to tell you what happened or something. Maybe he just got sick. He's somewhere. He's got to be somewhere. We just got to find him. Me and you, we got to find him. We got to go. What's the matter with you, Walter? When a cat take off with your money, he don't leave you no roadmaps. Willie, don't do it. Please don't do it, man. Not with that money. Man, money, please. Not with that money. Oh, God. Don't let it be true. Man, I trusted you, man. I put my life in your hands. That money is made out of my father's flesh. I'm sorry, Walter. I had my life staked on that deal, too. Son, is it gone? Son, I gave you $6,500. Is it gone? All of it? Beneath this money, too? Mama, I never went to the bank at all. You mean your sister's school money? You use that, too, Walter? Yes, all of it is all gone. And really, that's the end of the story. Because what else is left? He done squandered the money that he made such a big hype about. He squandered that money.
Even in this pit of despair, there is hope because his wife, Ruth, says, I'll get 5 more jobs.
Yeah.
Benita gonna keep going to school. I mean, what's her name?
Benita.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Benita gonna keep going to school somehow. And we are going to still move into that house.
And
we're gonna pay the mortgage with wishes and dreams.
Jobs, Kari, jobs. They all gonna jobs. Get more. Even mama has to go back to work and get a job. Yep.
Yeah, we gonna work ourselves to death mm-hmm. in order to get a little bit of a spot in this earth.
Mm-hmm. And that Yay. Brings us to the end of that story. Kari, you want to take a quick break?
No. Real quick.
Okay. Go ahead, Kari.
I think it's also important to note that Walter goes ahead and calls the man from the covenant that represented the white neighborhood. And he's like, come on with that money because they was going to pay them not to move into that neighborhood.
Right.
Once the family finds out that Walter did this, there is a very important speech between mama and she's talking about all her husband went through and how it resulted in Walter. And if this is the type of man you want to be, then you make sure your son sees it. And once that man that represents the covenant comes into the house, mama's like, make sure your son stand right there and watch you, like kneel down on the people in front of the people who say you have no place on this earth. And once all that pressure and sense finally gets knocked into his head, Walter is like, we come from a proud family and we called you back to tell you we still ain't gonna take the money. And then they say, y'all, let's pack up and move into our house that we can't afford no more because of Walter. And it's all Walter's fault.
I'm glad you included that part because I wanted to skip because Walter really, took that money and ran with it. But so I'm glad you included it with it. For him, does that not give him a little recovery in his character?
because he's looking for a purpose in his life, something to be proud of. And maybe he's finally done something in this refusing the money that he can be proud of, and he can start to feel like a man in front of his son. That's the optimistic view.
Yeah. So just a little bit of that is character recovery, I'd say, because he has left such a bad impression throughout, in my opinion, throughout the book. So I think we should end it here and just talk a little bit about it for a few seconds.
Okay, let's do that. Let's take a break. Okay.
And Kari, we're back. So, would you recommend this book? And what are your final thoughts? What's your final verdict?
Yes, I would recommend this book, this play. It is a great read. It's very short. And there is so much packed into every line in the script. So yes, I'd recommend it. Yes, I love it. Now let's talk. Oh, what about you? Would you recommend it? Do you
absolutely
love it?
I love this. I love it. And reading it helped me even love it anymore, because I got the, not only have I seen it visually, but now I saw the words that describe each scene, you know, the setup for it. So yeah, I love it. And I would definitely recommend it. It's a short read. It's a 2-hour listen, if you will. So it's definitely worth it. So yeah.
That's a good point. On Hoopla, which is an app that ties to your library card, you may be able to find the original Broadway play in audio format like I did. And that is a less than 2-hour listen. Mm-hmm. If though you want to hear "Will it know" in the strongest Bahamian accent ever, I really encourage you to watch the movie with Sidney Poitier.
With Sidney Poitier, because that scene right there, I love it. Yes, for sure, for sure.
So what you want to talk about?
So listen, just the character, the depth of each character in her writing, I think is so great. Like you said, mom is here working hard for this family. She has worked hard for this family. And I think in the book, she's still working kind of No, she's not working, because she said, "I can go back to work." Mm-hmm. And she's in her 60s, so she's not working. But she's done all that she can for her family. And the children that she has produced seem to be very ungrateful. And even if Walter is having this existential crisis in his life at the age of 35, not that it's impossible, but nonetheless, he's having these issues in his life. It doesn't seem to be filled with appreciation. This crisis is not, he's making his crisis everybody's problem.
He doesn't even see everybody's problems.
Because he's making his problem their problem. And yes.
So they need to use their resources to solve his problem and his alone.
Absolutely. That part right there.
I think it's interesting that, yes, these parents have worked hard, but there's still such disparity in the haves and have nots of society that's all their children see. And they're both Benny and Walter are looking for ways to cement themselves in their role in life, whatever that is. And they are both frustrated in different ways. Yeah. And in the end, it's all about like racism and money. Like what kind of freedom would these people be able to live? How would they be able to fulfill their potential if they had the resources to just live instead of constantly worrying about living?
Right. Exactly. And so that is a struggle. But then you can see the child. I was going to say that there is a part in here where so they wanted, I'm going to skip the child part. I'm going to go to this part where he's like, the man wanted $10,000. Everybody was to contribute $10,000, but the man was willing to take $6,500. Mm-hmm. Walter should have picked up that scam there. Yeah. You said, "I need $10,000, but I could only bring you $6,500 and you were willing to take that. What you going to do with that? I thought we needed to have it. And wasn't there a contract written up that said $10,000? So what?
So Walter is not a man of morals or intelligence. I mean, we all have a certain areas of intelligence, like maybe you're socially intelligent, but not mathematically intelligent. But I see him as overall an unintelligent person that is so wrapped up in his own worries and thought pattern that he can't see the realities around him. He is willing to go to Capitol Hill and bribe everybody that's the idea. Let's go to Springfield and grease some pockets with my mother's money for a liquor store, which also, you know, can be argued is a detriment to society. Now, I'm about to go to the liquor store today, so don't get on me, but I'm just saying maybe that shouldn't be his dream.
Exactly. But it was, I don't know. I think it's a great piece of work because there's so much conversation that can be brought to it if we had more time and, you know, the whole day to talk about it. But it's so many nuances within the story that we could and within the characters that we could bring out and enjoy and explore. Again, the relationship with Benny and her two boyfriends and the feelings that Ruth was having as she was coping in her relationship with her husband, because she said herself that there was a deterioration there. There was something that she could no longer give him. He was changing. So what was behind that? We know he was in middle crisis and putting his issues all on everybody
else. He was ruining the good thing in his life because he was so worried about the bad things, which justified, like his worries, his concerns, all justified until you go to the point where you are now just rude and evil and basically stealing money from your family. But he's not the villain at all. Like, I don't care for him as a person, but I also don't see him as the villain. Wait, but maybe he is. No, because society is the villain. There we go.
Yeah, the overall villain. Well, that's enough time, I think.
Alexis, what are we reading next week?
Metamorphoses by Kafka.
Yeah, Franz Kafka. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all for listening to Lit Society. We'll see you next Thursday. Lit Society is brought to you by Alexis Anaria and Kari Herrera. Support the cause by leaving a 5-star review for our show on Apple Podcasts, along with a comment about why you absolutely love us.
We love you too.
Yeah, leave that comment on Spotify too. You can do that over there. If you've enjoyed what you've just heard, tell a friend about Lit Society. Visit LitSocietyPod.com for show notes, this month's book list, and to sign up for our amazing email newsletter. And until next time, you guys,
read something.